Du lytter til Investering på Hjernen, en podcast om investering og det, der foregår i hovedet, når du investerer. Velkommen til Investering på Hjernen. I dag skal vi tale med Gerald Ashley omkring, hvordan vi som mennesker træffer beslutninger. Han er englænder, så jeg begynder at snakke engelsk nu. As human beings, we do not like uncertainty. We very much prefer to sort of know what's coming, but this can lead to other shortcomings. Risk and uncertainty are not the same, as today's guest will explain. Today's guest is Gerald Ashley, an advisor and public speaker on decision-making and uncertainty. Gerald has worked more than 35 years in international finance. Welcome, Gerald.
Yeah, and it's good to join you.
So maybe not all my guests know you, although you are quite well known and you have actually also spoken in Denmark. So I have this thing I call my quick round to get to know you. So I'll give you two choices and you just say which you prefer. Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Although you're British?
I know. I'm the only Englishman in the world that doesn't like tea.
Is it all the years in finance that converted you into coffee?
I don't know. I think as I've got older, I've drunk more and more coffee, which is probably not a good thing.
No. So I think something can be bad in everything and also in coffee. What do you prefer to read, fiction or nonfiction?
Nonfiction. I must admit, I don't read much fiction. I think that's probably a kind of gap in my thinking, because I've always been gripped by history and biographies, and I've never really got into fiction in a big way, which I think is not something to be proud of, but it's just the way I've tended to read.
Mm. So primarily non-fiction. What do you prefer in the evening, Netflix or exercise?
Oh, Netflix. I wouldn't want to exercise in the evening anyhow. I do quite like long walks during the day, but in the evening I'll put my feet up.
Okay. Dog or cat?
Sorry?
Dog or cat?
Oh, dog or cat. Dog. Though they're more work, but at least they're friendly.
Yeah, exactly. And they don't behave like they can live without you.
Exactly.
So when you are investing, is it short or long side?
As I've got older, I've taken a longer view, which is strange in a way, maybe. But I think it's kind of maybe what we're going to come and talk about in a few minutes, that I think short-term views don't really work consistently. I mean, a lot of people have good runs and then they take a serious hit. Also, it swallows up your entire life. I mean, if you know, it's all very well saying you're a day trader and you're going to spend most of your day on the golf course. No, you're not. You're going to spend 12 hours a day in front of a screen.
You have to. You have to, yes. So, yeah. so you, in my view, you have gotten wiser over the years. But you used to do short trading as well.
Yeah, well, my background was running trading books, so it kind of in your DNA then. And as I've got older, so maybe I stepped away from that part of the marketplace, I've realized that activity is not the same as success. Whereas, you know, if you're an intermediary, if you're a broker or you're a bank or you're a market maker, activity is a big source of making money and your success. Now, conversely, as an investor or short-term trader, constantly jumping in and out, I don't think is to one's advantage.
I completely agree with you on that. And I've also taken a different view during my years, because I also used to do short-term trading beforehand. So when you do this investing, is it high or low risk, in your opinion?
I don't know the answer to that. This podcast is not 12 hours long, because it would probably take that long. But what I would say is I actually, and this has served me quite well over the last few years, or certainly the last year, I have shied away from bond markets. And bond markets were characterized as low risk or less risk. To me, they looked horrifically risky when there was extremely low or zero interest rates.
Exactly.
And again, as I get older, I'm going to be really wise when I'm in my 80s at this rate. But as I get older, I just like companies that have consistent profitability and dividend payments. Now, you may miss out on stocks that fly up from nowhere as startups and all the rest of it, but that presumes a huge amount of either knowledge, luck, or timing. I don't profess to have any of those, so I tend to stick to global macro equities, which if on the where do we put those on a risk scale of 1 to 10? I'm going to say 6 to 7, something like that.
It's lower than private equity, and it might be higher under normal circumstances than bonds. But as you also said, with the low interest rates, bonds looked sick. You could get a very low or negative rate, depending on what country you were in. For waiting for disaster to happen. And then this year, or no, not last year, disaster happened for bond owners.
So, yes, and I think I just like things that actually are generating business and generating consistent dividends. Very late in my investment life, I've come to spend a much more time looking at, I think people sometimes call them dividend kings. These are long-term equities with maybe 10, 20, even 30 years of dividend increase
history. I think they're called aristocrats.
Yeah, well, there you go. It's kings, aristocrats, emperors, whatever you like. Yeah. But there's a strong reason for looking at those. But people, of course, get bored with waiting. They like to jump about and do things. Plus, as I said a little earlier, the marketplace is geared to making people jump up and down and do things all the time.
The marketplace, the media, the banks or brokers, they're all interested in us being active. So, yeah, everything is rigged towards being active. Which leads me to my last quick round question, which is, so when you do equities, is it stock picking or investment funds?
Well, again, I've been on a little bit of a journey here. I've given up on stock picking. It's just a hell of a lot of work, and you've got to think about how you balance the portfolio. So I don't outsource my investment decision completely. So I don't actually do trackers, for example. But what I do is in the UK, I invest in investment trusts, or in the United States, they call them, I guess they're mutual funds, aren't they? And here you are sort of still having to make a decision because you've got to look at which sectors you go into and you've got to choose your fund manager.
So you're choosing active fund managers to do the work for you.
Yeah, so it would be active rather than passive.
Yeah.
I think the problem with passive is that you, by definition, are going to miss out on some good situations. The argument against active management is many active managers aren't very good. And so or they actually hide behind the benchmark and they don't do very much active investment and they charge a nice fee. Mm. Now, what we're saying here is if you're not stock picking, at some level, you're going to be manager picking. Effectively, and sector picking, which I guess is what I do. I particularly like managers I've never heard of. I'm really nervous of star managers. In the UK, we have a few. There are a number of well-known ones in the United States. And to me, they have a very good run, and then they blow up. And so I try to avoid that. So this all sounds very dull and boring, but in a funny sort of way, I think that may be where investment success lies.
in manager picking.
Yeah, and I think manager picking, not trying to be too clever, and of course the killer card, and this helps if you're younger, but when you're younger, you ignore all this sort of advice, is reinvestment of income. The compounding effect of dividend income is astonishing. Many listeners will know this bit of maths, but very quickly, if you can earn 7%, in fact, 7.2% per annum, you double your money every 10 years.
Exactly.
Well, that's not so nice when you're 60. It's pretty good if you're 30 or even 40. And, you know, a lot of people worry, oh, they're a bit late maybe with the investments. And the reason to be worried is if they've not had the opportunity to roll up past income, because that is an incredibly powerful element. Of course, the marketplace doesn't talk about that because that's dull, that's boring, and it doesn't involve lots of commissions and overreaction to short-term volatility.
And media doesn't like it either.
Finding good income sources is important. Mm.
Du lytter til Investering på Hjernen med Jens Bælle. Very good. That was the quick round. Now we know a little more about you. But what do you do for a living these days, John?
That's a very good question. I do anything legal that pays, I guess. But more seriously, for the last 20 years, I've been running a sort of risk consulting business with two or three other guys. That's pretty much wound down now.
Okay.
My business partners are older than me. I'm in my mid-60s. We're all kind of hanging our boots up. So I spend more time on writing. I do quite a lot of public speaking. And I occasionally appear on distinguished podcasts such as yourself.
Oh,
glad and you so this allows this kind of allows me more freedom to talk about things. Because obviously when you work for another firm, you're very constrained. When you have your own firm, which I was a partner in, you're still constrained by you don't want to upset clients and this, that, and the other. So I wouldn't say I've gone completely rogue or out of control, but I feel much less constrained on saying my opinions.
Constrained and perhaps also less biased because of those constraints, you could say.
Well, you know, I think the financial industry is in a straitjacket in many ways. It's surrounded by benchmarks. Nobody really talks about whether benchmarks are even remotely sensible. The regulatory framework obviously has a place. We want a safe place for people to invest their money, but it's equally a huge burden. And I think a lot of it is kind of just box ticking and a waste of time. So you're right that if you're actually really directly involved in investment management, it's a very constrained world. I have one foot in the investment world in that I'm a non-exec director of a global equity fund. So unsurprisingly, I've just been talking about global equities, but I'm not going to promote the firm. But as a non-exec director, I am allowed to be the devil's advocate. So that kind of suits me quite well.
Hmm. Good. So it's you have a vast experience and now you are writing more books. You already did three, though, didn't you?
Yeah, I must tell you or tell listeners that there are three stages to writing a book. The first stage is you go around boasting that you're going to write a book. You've got a publishing deal or whatever. And then you leap to the third stage, which is where you hopefully go to a cocktail party and you bore people silly about how you've just written a book and how wonderful it is. The trouble is stage two in the middle, which is writing it. I don't think of myself as a natural writer. And you can tell from this podcast, I'm more at ease talking about these things than writing about them. Plus, dare I say, I think it's a very crowded field. There are a million books on investment. There are hundreds of there are probably 10,000 books on behavioral investment or behavioral biases and all the rest of it. And That's not to say some of them aren't extremely good, but I'm not certain I've got anything new to add to that particular area.
So right now you are in stage two on your next book.
Well, no, I'm on a stage one of going around saying I might write one.
Oh, okay.
but you may be able to interview me in 5 years' time and find me still on stage one.
Okay. We can get back to that at a later time then. So let's talk about today's topic, uncertainty. As I mentioned in my opening remark, humans do not like uncertainty. How do we cope with this dislike as investors?
Well, I think let's get a couple of first principles down. We talk a lot about risk, and particularly in the marketplace, we talk a lot about uncertainty. Just imagine a scale at one end where something is perfectly certain, 100% certain. I'll come back to that in a minute. And right down the other end, we've got 0% of certainty. We've got total uncertainty. That one may be familiar to a lot of people because it's the famous Donald Rumsfeld quote of unknown unknowns. We don't know about something, and we don't even know that it may be going to cause us a problem. So we have zero information on it. Now, in between 100% and zero, we've got this slippery thing called risk. And it is slippery because it's on a kind of a slope, which I'll come back to. Let's jump back to 100% certainty. Philosophers listening to this will, of course, already be shouting at the loudspeaker because there is no such thing as 100% certain. I mean, people who know far more mathematics than me will talk about Gödel's principle that you can't actually prove an equation and you go round and round in circles as to what is mathematically certain. But for the purposes of this podcast, let's say there are situations that are very close to certain. We all experience them every day. A really good one would be sunsets and sunrises. And that fits a lot of the bill for certainty because it happens on a regular basis. We've got a huge amount of past history. You can go all the way back to ancient Egypt where they aligned temples with the sun and this, that, and the other.
A lot of data points.
You know, it's on a very regular cycle. And so we can say with a huge degree of certainty, not 100%, but with a huge degree, that we could work out the sunrise in Copenhagen in 300 years' time on a particular day. And the only caveat to that would be if there was some dramatic change in the cycle. I don't know, the sun explodes or the world melts down, I don't know, nuclear war or something. But in general, you could produce sunrise and sunset tables right the way through. Now, that appeals to us because, look, there's something you can anchor around. There's something you know. And I think when we come to look at the investment experience, obviously we don't have 100% information. We may have 40, 50, 60, 70% information. In theory, all investors start with the same amount of investment knowledge in that, you know, we're not supposed to have insider dealing or any of these sort of things. But in practice, some people probably do have more information than others. And whether they act on that in an ethical manner, who knows? But we're in this area of what we might call risk. And what we do with risk is we look at past data. So in investment, we might look at company results. We might look at the sector, might look at the general state of the index. For people who like these things, they may look at charts. They may fret a lot about Federal Reserve data. Whatever it may be, we try and build in a lot of data into our investment decision. But there will always be a degree of uncertainty about it. Now, as we slide right the way down towards zero and what I think we can term total ignorance, we move away from that risk area, an area where there's quite a lot of data and you can apply tools like VAR or various distribution models. We get into a very unpredictable area because there's only 20 or 30% information. A good example of this would be the life insurance industry. Fortunately, this is a sound interview, so listeners don't have to see my non-athletic shape. But I am in my mid-60s. I could do with losing a bit of weight. I don't do a huge amount of exercise, as I explained earlier, though I go on long walks. And I have had relatives who've died very young, one in his early 50s, and I have others who've lived into their late 80s, almost 90s. Now, you look at me as an individual risk with that data, would you insure me? It's difficult. It's not really quite enough information. But you could take 100,000 guys who enjoy a drink, don't exercise, mid-60s, and you could build a portfolio of those individual uncertainties. And by doing so, you generate more information. And you compare that to a mortality table, and you create a risk, and you can sell life insurance. So if we can take uncertainties and turn them into risks, we can make money. And let me try and give you a non-detailed example of the opposite. So how could it be that we are so stupid that we turn risks into uncertainties? Well, the classic example now, it's a little bit of ancient history, 2008-09, was credit derivatives. In the old days, the credit market was very simple. I lent you money. I knew you. You knew when you had to repay me. We had an agreement. Obviously, that bilateral relationship involved a lot of information swapping between us. And, you know, I genuinely knew you from a credit risk point of view. Now, as time's gone by, that now seems like ancient history because people started creating bundles of loans, securitizing them, selling them on as investment products. And then if that wasn't enough fun, they, and of course, lots of profit margins, they turned them into derivatives, and we ended up with things called CDO squared, collateral default obligations squared, which was a million miles away from you and I and our little bilateral relationship of loan.
They were actually making money on the volume, so they were keen on getting more volume because they weren't taking any risks. They were passing that on
absolutely,
and getting paid doing
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. But what they ended up doing was that the investors had bought a bundle of uncertainties, which had been priced as a risk. And so you're right, the intermediary made all the money, but when the music stopped, people found they had even less information than when they would have started because it had been so sliced and diced. So if people from this conversation have got this mental model, now you can start to see that the key, and this is, you know, this is no great revelation, but the key to all of this is information and continually looking for more information. And I think being wise enough to realize we're not in the business of sunsets and sunrises. Things aren't a nice, neat cycle. They don't have perfect past data. And so there's always going to be a degree of unknown or general uncertainty. And maybe this widens to a philosophical point, which is actually, are some things inherently unpredictable? And I think that's an uncomfortable thing for the human being. We want certainty. We want a solution. We want everything nailed down. And so we get gripped by models. You know, I say to you, I've got this model that can predict this. Oh, fantastic. I'll have one of those. But when you stand back and look at it, what is that model really doing? And what information is it relying on? And is that information stable? Whereas a lot of information is not. It's dynamic and it floats all over the place.
One problem creating perhaps a lot of this uncertainty is actually us human beings. I think it was Sir Isaac Newton who once said after the South Sea bubble, I can calculate the motion of heavenly bodies, but not the madness of people. So he started off, like you said, with the sunsets and the sun rises. That's a heavenly body moving. And he ended up with the people, as you did.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good example, because if we stopped at Newtonian mathematics, it was almost a mechanical sort of machine. You know those lovely old instruments you can get with the sun and the planets all spin round and all the rest of it, and that, you know, that has an enormous appeal, that I can turn the handle and I can see where Earth is compared to Mars, exactly, and Saturn and all the rest of it. Yeah. And of course, financial markets are just not a mechanical setup like that. So
in other words, it's easier to build a model of the planets and how they move, whereas
yes,
how we react, how we think, those models are much more difficult to create.
Du lytter til Investering på Hjernen. Husk at abonnere, så du ikke går glip af et afsnit.
I think you have a wonderful example of this. You put in certain parameters in this, with the marriage of Prince, or now he's King Charles, football results, and the death of popes. Can you explain that?
Well, I think an area that, you know, after listening to this, people may want to go about and kind of take a look at is something called complex adaptive systems. And this is really the point you make, that there isn't a nice linear relationship between inputs and outputs. And from an education point of view, we're very much used to inputs and outputs. So, you know, you get a recipe to make a cake, you know all the measurements, you take all the instructions and you bake a cake. And in general, you should come out pretty much with the answer you're expecting. Now, maybe another mental model for people to think about, and of course this will resonate particularly with people in the UK, but it kind of works everywhere, is I often think of the banking system or the financial system as a bit like the London Underground map, or for that matter, any other metro system. And it's a completely wrong way to think about it. But there's a general expectation that if we think the stations are the banks, and you can look at all the connections. So obviously the stations in the center of a system, and so I'm going to rely now on London, something like Piccadilly Circus or Oxford Circus, they almost by definition are very well connected. And then as you get out to the edge of that metro system, the stations may only have one or probably max of two connections. Now, if you transport that mental model into thinking about if you were a central bank, whether you're the Bank of England or the Fed or the Danish Central Bank, they try to map all the relationships between banks. And they tend to say, well, the big stations, the big boys, the Citibanks, Deutsche Bank, JP Morgan, etc., Barclays, they must be very important because they've got all these connections. And then the small private banks and smaller institutions on the edge, well, we don't need to worry so much about them because they're kind of small. That worked well until the collapse of Lehman Brothers, where Lehman Brothers were thought to be a middle-ranking bank, if that. But what they didn't understand, or the authorities didn't choose to look closely enough, were there were many relationships that Lehman's had with other banks that were not on the map. And in particular, this was prime brokerage. So this was where the minnows would come to Lehman's and say, can we use the Lehman's name so we can get a better credit activity in the marketplace? So when Lehman's collapsed, it turned out they were much more connected to a network or a system than we had thought. And I think this is what complexity is about, is the idea that stop thinking of metro system maps. Think of flocks of birds. Think of things that are much more kind of fluid. There's a very famous philosopher called Karl Popper, who wrote a paper called Clocks and Clouds. And that's what we've just been talking about, which this is a paper from the 1950s, where he said that, some systems are mechanical, they're like a clock, but other systems are like clouds, and you can't use a mechanical system to delineate a cloud. But that doesn't stop us from trying to do it, because it's easier to understand how a clock works, and we feel more comfortable with it, because when you turn the handle, it does certain things. So I'm afraid we often look at markets as clockmakers, and we're dealing with clouds.
Yeah, and we all know that the weather reports are very uncertain. We should also learn to figure out that the market forecasts or market reports are also uncertain.
Yeah, one thing slightly in favor of the weather guys is they're a lot better than they used to be, because they've now got enormous amounts of data and they are throwing huge amounts of computing power at it. But still, what they're doing at the end of the day is looking at back data and really sort of grinding it down as far as they can. And there's an old joke about data that if you torture it enough, it'll give you the answer you want. When we come to market forecasts, I have a slightly cynical view. Let's say you're the client and I'm in an investment bank and I'm a sales guy. Well, I've got to have a reason. I want you to trade with me. I want you to do something. So I've got to ring you up. I might invite you out to a golf day, but maybe I can give you some bit of meaningless information about Iranian missiles or some geopolitical stuff. Or I say to you, well, I know, Jens, you're very interested in, the Norwegian kroner. We've got a research guy who writes nothing but forecasts and in-depth analysis to keep you happy about the Norwegian kroner. That's not to say that isn't a genuine attempt to do it, but the underlying motive is to get you to jump on the phone or onto the PC and do some transactions. And we're back to what we said earlier, that the marketplace is all about short-term activity and responding and volatility. And maybe I'm right or wrong, but as I get older, I feel the short term is less and less important.
But there's not much earning for the investment bank in buy and hold strategies. So they need to make people want to do changes to their portfolios.
Absolutely, absolutely right. I mean, we're kind of having a go at them, and I come from an investment banking background for many years, so should defend it a little bit. But there is a tension, if you like, between intermediaries and end users, and it's kind of pointless not to admit to that.
Exactly. So, do you have any knowledge? You said that the weather reports have gotten better. Do you know of any studies showing that the investment forecasts have gotten any better?
No, I would say. But there again, we talked about star managers earlier.
Yes.
And we've gone through periods of time, and not so much currently, but if you go back to the dot-com era, which I now know seems like the Middle Ages, but there were star analysts who were followed. Two or three names come to mind without naming them on Wall Street. They only had to name a stock and everybody piled in and all the rest of it. And that was kind of self-fulfilling for a while, but I don't think there was any long-term evidence that they were any particularly better. But we're at fault as the end users, because, and it's not just in finance, it's in anything. All the time we want the answer. So I'm saying to you, Jens, I've got a problem. Can you give me a solution? Or I'm your boss and I say, are you certain about this? Are you doing the right thing? There's tremendous, we are buyers of certainty. And so anybody who's selling it, they could be guys, you know, selling crazy medical cures. They may be religious gurus. Mm-hmm. They may be analysts at investment banks. They may be sales guys in software and IT who say, look, if you have my piece of IT, I solve your problem. And, you know, that's a part of modern life.
Yeah, and at this time of the year, in January, it is the time of selling your forecast of what's going to happen this year. A lot of people are really digging into reports or forecasts from financial institutions on what are we expecting of 2023. Hold tight and listen in.
I think is there almost a kind of confessional or religious aspect to this? That, you know, you have a rough year and you get to December and you say, okay, well, I'm going to draw a line. I'm going to start again. And next year I'm going to be a better investor, or I'm going to go on a diet, or I'm going to walk the dog more, whatever. There's this feeling that as the calendar goes round, you get a chance to start again. And again, you know, I'm in the market now for, if you've got a magic diet, or you've got a really good gym membership thing, or you said, look, it's very obvious infrastructure stocks are going to do well this year, I'm in the market to buy all that. I reckon that kind of lasts till about the middle of March, where everybody's given up and forgotten about it.
Exactly. And luckily for the analytic people. Du kan lære mere om investorpsykologi i bogen Når hulemænd investerer af Jens Balle. Find den på averagejoe.dk eller i din boghandel. Another thing is that you talked about market gurus or people who were good at forecasting investments. What I see that has been different this time is that those people who got all the attention on forecasting and being good at it, they are not working in banks anymore. They have their own platforms on Instagram, on TikToks, on Facebook, or wherever. They do blogs, and they come with all these predictions and tell people to buy Tesla and cryptos. And then in the markets that we have just seen, where everything went up almost over time, they became kings of the market, and everybody was listening to them. Because then people perceived receiving some sort of certainty, because they would tell them, well, we made success by doing this, you should do the same thing.
I think this may be a wider issue actually as well, which is driven by the collapse in the cost of computing and bandwidth. So we could not have done this call 30 years ago. We might have been able to do it 10 or 15 years ago, but it would have been probably easier to have done it in a studio. It would have cost a lot of money and all the rest of it. So the first thing to say is that you've got a much wider pool of so-called experts who have got instant access to a very large audience. So almost by definition, if you have a million people making predictions, at least somebody must be right. I mean, this is the conundrum about Warren Buffett, because everybody says, oh, well, all I'm going to do is, you know, I'm just going to be like Warren Buffett. Well, no, you're not. But even if you think you are, he's an outlier. He is not the norm. Also, it's not just him. It's his sidekick, Charlie Munger. They are as exceptional in investment as Usain Bolt is in running. And, you know, you might go out and buy some nice training shoes and think you can run a bit faster, but you're not going to be Usain Bolt. So I think, again, you're we're searching after some sort of magic answer all the time. If only I could find the right analyst, the right fund manager. You know, it turns out the guy down the local bar is a genius at picking stocks, or maybe racehorses or whatever it is. We constantly try to buy the certainty.
Yeah, exactly. Speaking of Warren Buffett and his group of people, I mean, he is an outlier because he started investing in stocks when he was, I think, 10 years old. And by the age of 15, he had a huge sum back then, $5,000, I read somewhere, invested in equities. And he kept doing it like that. I mean, if he was starting off today, he would have multiple times done a sale of his company because private equity firm would buy it or whatever, and he did.
Yeah, and the money's become unimportant because there's only so much money you can spend. And in fairness to him, he's kind of giving most of it away in some shape or form.
And he's not spending it. He's driving a middle class car. He lives in the same house as he bought in the '50s.
So exactly,
he's an outlier. He's also because he's a huge saver and of money, and he's earned the interest during the years.
Well, it's back to my 7% solution.
Exactly.
And if you're very good at stock picking, which he clearly was, and you've got a lot of patience, and you're willing to maybe go 50% offside in capital losses, then you may start to be in, you know, a cohort of people who can be like that.
But exactly,
you know, tiny number of people. But we don't have to do that. All we have to do is be kind of reasonably good. So there are a couple of little rules in investment that kind of work. I mentioned the one of reinvesting income if you can. The second one, which is a behavioral one, which is quite good for young people, but I think it's hard to do, is that you do your saving is the first thing you take out of your monthly pay.
Exactly.
Whereas, in fact, most people do the last, and we all understand why that's the case and all the rest of it. But if you could just put, maybe it's quite a lot of money, you could put 5% of your take-home pay away every month. It's very boring for the first 20 years, and then it starts to really move. Nobody's going to take this advice, of course.
No, it's very and even certainly not the young ones because they will think.
No, they just want to hear what the next. They just want to hear what the next hot stock is.
Exactly.
Where they can double their money in a week.
Yeah. So what should the normal investor do with this? Because we don't like uncertainty, but there is no certainty, and sometimes the reach for certainty gives us more risk than we really want because it's a false certainty. Do you have any advice for us?
Well, I think a good one, which we've kind of been hinting at without using the term, is to look at your investment horizon. So just get you, obviously, if you're 60 or 70, you not want a 25-year investment horizon. Maybe 10 years, 5 to 10 years. Certainly if you're in your 30s, you can have a 25-year investment horizon. Stop trying to smash the ball out of the park. Just, you know, again, this will be for a limited audience, but for cricket lovers, you go for the easy, quick singles. You're not trying to smash the ball out of the stadium all the time. And how do you do that? Well, I think you have to invest in some form of managed funds. You probably should have a range of managers, not too many. And if one is consistently bad on a 5-year horizon, you have to swap and make a change. You don't want to have to be watching the market 8 hours every day. You know, there is no freedom in day trading. It's a jail. And but all the marketing says, you know, I make $1 million every year and I'm on the golf course at 11 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. No, they're not. It's nonsense. So I wouldn't say the ordinary, I'd say for the professional investor is is take a good medium-term horizon, reinvest your income. And one thing which is very hard, but I think is very good, is when there's a stock market crash, don't sell. A large number of people sell after a stock market crash, and they crystallize their loss. So we've seen in the last year at some points, some markets have been down 20%, 25%. Some of them may be out of fashion for a very long time, like the tech sector. But there are plenty of other indices that went, they dropped a great deal and have started now to recover. But if you have sold out after a crash, you've crystallized your problem.
And actually, I've seen reports showing that during the financial crisis, it was mostly men doing the selling at the bottom. But So that leaves us as losers again.
Well, that's a whole nother podcast, and you should. Maybe we should try and find, or you should try and find a couple of female fund managers and see if they are really different or not different. It's kind of an interesting topic.
It is. So we should sort of invest like Michael Lewis explains how to run a baseball club in Moneyball. I don't know if you read that book, but he also said, don't go for the home runs. Find out how the whole team gets better by positioning differently.
Sure. So I get that.
Yeah.
But, and I it was very smart because he was looking for, in investment terms, assets that were mispriced.
Exactly. Instead of going after the ones that everybody wanted, they were also mispriced because everybody wanted it.
Yeah. But you're going to need a lot of knowledge. I couldn't have done that in baseball. I don't know one player from another.
Exactly.
And you need it's time and effort again.
Yeah.
The approach is completely legitimate and was seen in real life very successful. Of course, within its success is its seeds of destruction, because effectively you become an agent to making the marketplace more efficient.
Yeah.
So now you and I all know about inefficiencies in baseball. Once people like you and I know about it, it's too late.
Yeah, exactly. Har du idéer til emner eller gæster, du gerne vil høre mere om, kan du sende en besked fra hjemmesiden investeringpohjernen.dk. So we're going to have to round this up, although I would like to keep talking and hearing what you have to say. But I have some closing questions for you. What was your best and your worst investment?
My best investment last year, or on a longer period, if we say over a longer period.
Whichever you want.
Okay, well, let's get the disaster of last year out of the way. The worst area I had, I did have some investment in tech stocks in a fund, and that's not been fun. No. But it wasn't my entire investment.
Are you still happy with the manager doing it, though?
Yes, I think are good managers in a very bad sector.
Mm. And that was a bad sector last year.
Yeah, which is kind of makes it tricky.
Yeah.
One area I did quite well in, though it certainly wasn't without its volatility, was infrastructure. And that I think is going to be a big thing in the future. In the longer term, if I look back at where I've tended to do well, it's been in the big macro stocks. I did have a very good run once in Japan, but I stayed in too long.
What's a macro stock?
It basically just Japanese equities, mainly large companies.
Okay.
There was a time when smaller companies in Japan were very good, but in fact, if you were starting again now, it might be time to think about Japan. I don't know, but I didn't do as well as I could. But it was a good sector.
Mm.
Somewhere that I've never made money out of is, or never consistently been very good at, is very specialist trusts. So occasionally I've looked at one or two startup trusts for healthcare or for venture capital, and I'm a perfect reverse indicator. If I come on and tell you you should buy this thing, please don't. I can feel myself buying into the excitement of discovering something, and then I often wish I hadn't.
Mm. Well, maybe that we could use that as a indicator and launch exactly. it and make exactly. money off it. Even.
Well, the key thing with indicators is consistency, right? Mm. So if you meet somebody who's consistently bad, they're worth a fortune to you.
Exactly. As an advisor, I once had a guy call in and ask of our five, what we were thinking of right now in the Danish market was the five worst equities to buy.
Right.
And I asked our an analytic guy, and he gave me five names, and I passed them on. And then he bought for an amount in each of them. And he said, well, you certainly can't pick the winners, so now I'm going to see if you can, how good you are at picking the losers. And,
well, there used to be a theory, which I'm sure is still around, I just don't follow it anymore, called the Dogs of Wall Street, which is you buy the worst of last year's stocks and some stay very bad, but you often have two or three that bounce back and your overall return can be quite good. But
I once knew a Danish portfolio manager who made a fund of that so that you could invest in, and he would buy the five worst Danish stocks every year and close very, very fast because they continued being bad. So
yes.
So do you have any suggestions other than your own books, which I'm going to list and make a link to where to find them, of course. But do you have a suggestion for listeners on books on either this decision-making or investing or investor psychology?
There are a large number of them out there. It's difficult to pick any in particular. Maybe away from investment, but a very good book about thinking about things differently and looking at from the world of marketing and how we are influenced is a book called Alchemy by, I must admit, a good friend of mine, Rory yeah. Sutherland. Yeah. And he's a very sharp guy, and yes. that's an exceptionally good book. On investment, there's the obvious classic of Peter Lynch, One Up on Wall Street, which I think is probably very long in the tooth now, maybe 20, 30 years old. But he, in a way, I've been repeating a lot of his points. Mm. And then if you want a general, I'm trying to think of a good general book on risk. There's a book, I can't remember the name of the author, but it's called Against the Odds. Oh, no, sorry, Against the Gods, The History of Risk.
The other one is Against the Odds. Phil Collins.
Yeah, Against the Gods, and it's by somebody called Peter something, and his name escapes me at the moment. Mm. And it's a very good book because it looks at the history of how humans have tried to grapple with risk over the last 2,000 years. And it's the same issues come up that we've been talking about over the last half an hour or so. My Peter Bernstein, it's just come to me, Bernstein. And I can recommend that one.
Yeah, I think I read it back in about 15 years ago.
I was going to say it's 15, 20 years ago, but it's a good overall description of understanding risk.
Yeah, I'll pass that on to my listeners and write in the show notes. My last question is, if you could give your own 25-year-old self a good advice on investing, what would that be?
If we were to go back in time and start all over again, I think don't chase returns. Reinvest income where you can and be patient. Avoid anything that is exciting. When a market is described as exciting, you're likely to lose money. Because you will be one of the people, you'll be an outsider who's buying towards the top of a move. And I think of past periods of excitement, I can think of the markets in 85, 86, 87, particularly the dot-com almost mania of 98, 99, and then into 2000 when the music stopped. Anything that is very, very exciting, just avoid it. If you want excitement, do something else in life. Don't use your investment portfolio for it. Take up skydiving or motor car racing or something like that.
Very sound advices, in my opinion. I'll pass them on. I can't pass them on to your own 25-year-old. I don't have any techniques for that. And probably you wouldn't listen, but now I've passed them on to, or you have passed them on to my listeners. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me today, Gerald. I'm very happy that you wanted to do this.
Jens, no, it's been a great pleasure. And all you have to do is roll up the income and you'll be fine.
That's a good advice as well. I'll pass that on. Thank you.
Du har lyttet til Investering på Hjernen. Mit navn er Jens Balle, og denne episode var redigeret af Emil Mantai.